Okay. So today we're pretty much going to wrap up the financing mix discussion. But I want to go back to where I left you on Monday, where we talked about this rational price. Okay. Let's back up. We're advising Disney to go out and borrow $39.5 billion and buy back stock, right? It's a big deal. And the question we're addressing is, if I'm going to do a buyback, at what price should I offer the people who are buying back? And I said a fair solution would be for everybody to get an equal share of the increase in value. I think the increase in value we came up with is $19.6 billion. And the fairest solution is to take that $19.6 billion, divide by the total number of shares outstanding, and you get this $10.90 increase. So I'm going to make an assertion and then back this up. If Disney goes out and buys back shares at $78.61, it's awfully precise, but I'm being precise for a moment, here's what's going to happen. The people who sell their shares back will get a $10.90 increment. The people who stay in the company will get a $10.90 increment because I've designed it so everybody gets a fair share. And that's why I call it the rational solution. Doesn't always happen. But let's say you're at Disney and you're planning this buyback, and you want to, of these two groups, which one would you like to keep happier, the ones who are selling their shares and leaving the company or the ones who are staying in the company? Staying in the company because they're going to be your shareholders in the future, right? So what's your best case scenario here? If you care only about the shareholders to stay in your company, what would you be able to, you know, it might not be practical, but what would you be able to like to do? Remember, the stock price right now is $67.71. What's, in a sense, your best case scenario in your buyback? Or you want that to happen anyway, but what if you could do the buyback at $67.71? That would require an incredibly short-sighted group of shareholders. But actually, Disney had those shareholders in 2013. The Bass Brothers, who are these Texas-based group, had, you know, the big oil people, the big share of Disney. They were a little, you know, desperate for cash. They owned a big piece of Disney. What if you could approach one of them and say, you know what, we'll buy your share, because normally they take a discount trying to sell that big block. I know it takes a lot of, it might require a lot of luck, but if you could buy the shares back at $67.71, I want to figure out what will it do to the remaining shareholders. So I want you to remember the $78.61. That's what your price would be if I bought back at the fair price. Now I'm going to try this experiment of what if I could buy the shares back at this much lower price because somebody wants to get rid of their shares. So here's the framework we're going to use to answer that. First, you've got to figure out how much you're going to buy back, which depends on how underlevered you are. In the case of Disney, that's a $39.5 billion. You divide that by the price at which you buy back the shares. That's the number of shares you remove from circulation. Your share count is going to drop by those shares. If you divide the value of equity you're going to have by those remaining shares, you're going to get the new share price after the buyback. So let's assume I can buy back the shares at $67.71. So $39.2 billion is the additional debt I'm taking to get to my optimal debt ratio. I take that debt, I buy back the shares at $67.71. I'm going to buy back, you know, in this case, about 570 million shares. My share count is going to go from 1.8 billion down to 1.22 billion. So I've removed the shares from circulation. Remember, when you buy back shares in this process, you don't keep them as treasury stock. In fact, you're not allowed to do that in the US in the long term. It's almost like you're having a bonfire in the back of the company and you're removing those shares from circulation. If you look at what the company is going to be worth after they go to their optimal, we computed the new value of the company to be $153.5 billion. That's with the $19.6 billion additional increase in value from going to the optimal. You subtract out the new debt that you're going to have and add back the cash. The value of the equity you're going to have after the buyback is $102.3 billion. There's a point to all of this. If you divide the $102.3 billion by the remaining shares, the value that you get per share is $83.78. So remember, you were the shareholders who stayed in the company? Instead of getting the $78.61, which is what you were getting before, you are now getting 83. And why are you getting more? Because you got to keep the entire $19.6 billion for yourself. You're essentially sharing none of it with the people selling their shares back. So when you do a buyback at a price lower than that rational price, that's good for the remaining shareholders, bad for the people selling back. If you do a buyback at a price higher than your rational, you're actually tilting wealth away from your remaining shareholders to the ones who sell back. Yes, Sandeep.
So does that mean like the stock, as soon as this deal is completed?
Doesn't have to be complete. The minute it's announced. See, this is the thing about markets, right? Markets don't have to wait for deals to go through. That's why in an acquisition, when does the price of the target company jump? As soon as the announcement comes out. Because in a sense, it's the rational process playing through. So the question then you're asking is, why would those people buy back, sell their shares back? That's why you got to negotiate that deal before you announce it, because if you wait till after you announce it to go and try to do it, they're never going to do it. So if Disney wants to do this, they probably have to approach their largest shareholders who want to get out of their positions and offer them this deal and then announce the market, we've arranged for a buyback of shares of the Bass Brothers and it's this much money, and then the announcement effect will kick in. Yes, Tariq. You mean have an open clause in your corporate charter that that'll be a very dangerous clause, right? Because you know what'll happen. Yeah. Is there's a crisis, everybody's, you don't have the cash to do it, right? You'd have to back it up with all kinds of things. So you cannot, as a company, leave open a window where people can bring their shares back. It might actually be against SEC rules because it might be viewed as price manipulation to be removing shares from the market. So the whole set of rules that govern this process that prevent you from laissez-faire solutions. So that might be a solution that's off the table. Now, so any other questions about the mechanics? So I want you to think, in every buyback, there are two groups. There are people who sell their shares back and people who stay in. Whatever the price is will determine who wins and who loses in this transaction. Remember I said that 78.61 was the rational price? Let me back it up. If I go out and buy shares at 78.61, the share count will be 1,301. It'll be higher because I'll be buying back fewer shares. If I take the remaining equity value and divide by 1301, I get 78.61. So if you ever have doubts about is this a rational price, take it through the process and you should get the same price being paid to the people selling their shares back and the people who stay. Just as an exercise, here's what I want you to do. I want you to see what the price will be for the remaining shareholders if the buyback was at $85 per share, higher than the rational price. Because I said that's more likely to happen, actually, because bankers want to get deals done. Work out. In fact, work out what the break-even price has to be for you to make no money at all. In other words, if banks are cavalier and they push the price to $95, $100, there's going to be some price at which the remaining shareholders actually could end up being worse off than they were before the buyback in spite of the $19.6 billion increase in value. This is one of the things that people have used as a critique of buybacks. They said, companies tend to buy back shares at too high a price, this is terrible, to which my reaction is, if that's what you're worried about, what should you do? Your company or a shareholder announces a buyback, you know they tend to buy back shares at too high a price, rather than bitching and mourning about this, just sell your damn shares back. Be on the right side of this deal. So I've never understood that critique. That's what's worrying you. Why are you sitting there taking the punishment instead of joining the group that's taking, you know, that's selling at the higher price? It's a choice. It's not, it's voluntary. People choose to sell their shares back. Any questions about the process, the buybacks? So now we know, if you're asked, why should we do it? Don't go with the cost of capital argument. It's too small a change to convince anybody. Convert that change in the cost of capital into savings each year. Remember how we do that, by taking the enterprise value and multiplying by the cost of capital. Take the present value of those savings, and that difference is going to be why you should do it. And be very clear about where it's coming from. It's not coming from a greater business, better operations. It's coming from taking advantage of a tax code that is tilted in favor of debt. So second question, you should be asked, if any sensible board asks, sometimes I forget to ask this question, what if something goes wrong? Why? Because you take a company that has, you know, $15 billion in debt and make it have $55 billion in debt. It might be able to afford that debt today, given its earnings power. But bad things can happen to companies. You can have a recession, you can have a lawsuit. And if you're earning strop, all of a sudden you're in trouble. So when somebody says, what if something goes wrong? The one response you should never give is nothing will go wrong. Something will go wrong, and it's your job when you make a judgment on how much should I borrow to bring that into your decision process. Now, what is going wrong here? I'll tell you the key number that's driving your optimal debt ratio. This is a process driven by how much money you make. The greater your operating income as a company, the more I'm going to allow you to borrow. So this isn't based on what do you have as assets, what's on your balance sheet. It's based on your capacity to service debt. So really, everything that can go wrong can be framed in terms of what can happen to my operating income in a bad year. In the case of Disney, how would I answer that question? Look at the past, right? What did a bad year look like? Why? Because a bad year for Con Ed is a 10% drop in operating income. A bad year for Dell can be a 50% drop in operating income. You can't have one number fits all. So here's what I did. I basically went back and collected the operating income every year from 1987 through 2013 and computed the percentage change each year. What's a bad year? A year in which my operating income drops. The standard deviation operating income is about 19%. That tells me how volatile it is. The more volatile your income, the higher that percentage. And the worst year I had during this period, I think, was 2000, the 29.5% drop. What happened in 2000, God only knows. I didn't even go dig. But to me, I'm getting perspective on what does a bad year look like for this company. You do the same table for Con Ed. I think their worst year is like an 8% drop in operating income. Earnings per share are going to be much more volatile because of leverage. Why? Because of a regulated utility. It's not like people turn off the power entirely during a recession. There's not much variance. What does that mean? I'm less worried about Con Ed going to its optimal and bad things happening than I am when I'm looking at a technology company where a bad year can be a 50% drop in operating income. So when you have history, you can look at the history. And I also looked at how is Disney done during recessions? Why do I care? Because one of the big reasons operating income declines is because of a macroeconomic event. So I looked at 1981 through 82. That was the earliest recession I could trace the numbers through. They actually saw their operating income increase by 12% during that recession. That was an inflation-driven recession. That was the Paul Volcker recession. It tells you something about Disney's pricing power, because when companies do well during inflation, it's because they can pass inflation through to their customers. We'll come back and address whether that's true for Disney by looking at the numbers. But in 1991, another bad recession, their operating income dropped by 22%. 2002 dropped by 16%. 2009 dropped by 23%. Again, the numbers themselves are not the issue. It's you're getting a sense of what does a bad year look like. So looking at these numbers, I said, no, let's drop the operating income. Remember, the worst year they've had is a 29% drop, so I dropped it by 10%. Not much happened. The optimal stayed at 40. Dropped it by 20%. Not much happening. Still at 40%. 30% drop. Still at 40%. It's only if the operating income drops by more than 30% that you start to see an effect on the optimal debt ratio. I mean, when I do this analysis, I'm thinking about, you know, if I'm in front of the Disney board and they say, what if something goes wrong? It's because they're worried about downside, right? You know how I'd use this table to say it's okay for you to go? I'd say, look, even if you have a bad year, you're still at a debt ratio that I've suggested for you as your optimal. In contrast, if a 10% drop in operating income drop my optimal to 20%, I'm going to probably go along with them and say, you're right, you shouldn't be borrowing money. You're very sensitive to small changes in operating income. So when you look at your company, you're going to get an optimal with your existing operating income. Just as a word, if drop it by 5, 10%, it's going to give you a sense of how sensitive your optimal is. And that should play a role in whether you go to that optimal or hold back, maybe go to a lesser number. Now, the other way you worry about, yeah, go ahead, Chandra.
So if we have already borrowed at, say, like the optimal debt ratio of 40%, right?
You don't have to, right? Because in a sense, you have enough income to. See, the reason I say it's okay is, remember I computed your interest coverage ratio? You have enough buffer in there that a 20% drop in your operating income is not doing things to the interest coverage ratio that are bad enough that you go, your rating might drop from double A to single A. It's not dropping to single double B. That's what the downside risk is capturing, is how close are you to the edge? That if you get a shock to the system, you don't go over the edge. In this case, you're far enough away from the edge as Disney to be able to borrow 40% and not put yourself at risk of catastrophe if something happens. No. Yes? How much the optimal drops? It depends on when you got the interest coverage ratio, whether you were in the middle of the, so when I computed the optimal debt ratio for Disney at 40%, it's a question of whether I was at the closer to the lower end of that range for my rating to change. So the closer you're to the bottom of the range, a small tip will put you into the next one and then you spin out of control. And that's why I described cost of capital, not as a U shape, but you get this flat line and then you get that. You're avoiding the inflection point, right, as much as you can. Now, the other way people try to build in buffers, and it's sensible to build in buffers, is when I told you Disney's optimal was 40%, I said it's because their cost of capital was minimized, right? I never mentioned what their rating would be at 40%. This isn't the case, but what if their rating were double B at a 40% debt ratio? Remember, your optimal, your lowest cost of capital can be, I didn't constrain myself. Would you be okay with that double B rating? What's the magic, why did I pick a double B rating? It's below investment grade, and I'm asking, would you be okay if your lowest cost of capital is, if you are, and most companies would say, not really. So what's this magic about an investment grade? Why do we worry about, are you investment grade and above? What happens when you fall below investment grade? There are some bond funds that can't invest in you, so you worry about your market shrinking, your price being affected. What else? There's a news story, the day you drop below investment grade, right? There's a Wall Street Journal story that says XY, Disney drops to double B. Who's reading it? Everybody. Like who? Your suppliers, your customers. In the case of, remember those indirect bankruptcy costs we talked about? It might not be a great big deal for Disney, but if this happened at Boeing, you drop to double B, all of a sudden you get this call from Singapore Airlines saying that 25-year contract we signed last week, null and void. No, because we're not doing it with the double B. It triggers that meltdown of indirect bankruptcy costs we talked about. So there's a good reason for it. And it used to be until the early 1980s that if you drop below investment grade, you actually could not issue bonds in the market. Below investment grade companies couldn't have, people could trade bonds if they were double B, but original issuances for below investment grade companies, it's not, and you know who broke through that, right? Mike Milken, that was the Drexel Burnham revolution, was the opening up of original issuance to below, but it's still more difficult. The issuance costs are higher. So there's good reasons for an investment grade rating. So when a company says, look, you know, we want the lowest cost of capital, but subject to a constraint that the rating be at least triple B, I'm okay with that. So even if they say, we want it to be A because we want some buffer to the investment grade, okay with that. But there are some companies that will put in what I think is a completely unrealistic ratings constraint, which is we want to be AAA rated at any cost. Can you be AAA rated at any cost? Yeah. You said at any cost. Why do you want to be AAA rated? Because you want to have that ego boost up. I'm the only AAA rated company in this business. Look at me. But your shareholders are paying the price. I still remember talking to the CEO of a steel company in Europe. This is a long time ago. It was the last AAA rated steel company in the world. And I said, why is, and they were fixated with rating. Every decision in the company was framed through what will that do to our rating? Where they invested, how they expanded, how they financed. He said, what do you, and he said, that's easy because we can borrow money at a really low rate. And I said, how do you keep your AAA rating? You know what his answer was? We never borrow money. This is the kind of circular logic that makes you a CFO. So you're really interested in a AAA rating because it lets you borrow money at a really low rate, but the only way you keep the rating is by never borrowing money. Hey, I would take a AA rating where you actually borrowed money at a low rate over a AAA rating. You will run into managers like this who will insist on a rating. You know it's completely unrealistic. They say, I want that rating at any cost. Rise to the challenge. Give them the bill. I'm going to explain to you how you give them the bill. But when somebody puts a rating constraint, estimate how much it will cost in value and tell them who's paying the price. The shareholders are basically giving up this many billion dollars so you can have this ego boost of, I'm the only AAA rated company in this sector. So I'm going to try this on Disney. I'm going to fill in the details. At the optimum of 40%, Disney's synthetic rating is single A. I think that's good enough. But let's say Disney's managers came back and said, we want a AA rating. That's our constraint. Can I do it? All I have to do is go back to that spreadsheet and not only to keep track of the cost of capital, I don't even have to build in some quantitative fix. Just look at the rating and say, oh, you know what? I can't get to 40% because it puts me at trip. I'll have to stop at a 30% debt ratio. Will that cost them? At a 30% debt ratio, the cost of capital is higher than at 40%. That's why I picked the 40%, the lowest cost of capital. I value the company at a 30% debt ratio, and guess what? It'll cost their shareholders about $6 billion. You know, if you're a $150 billion company, I can live with a $6 billion drop if it makes you more comfortable as a manager. And you say, remember, we're doing this because you're saying as a decision maker in the company, I make better decisions as a AA rated company. Okay, $6 billion. If the same managers came back to me and said, I want a AAA rating, I go back to the spreadsheet, and turns out that I have to stop at 20%. I was surprised I got even up to 20%. I thought I'd be shut down at 10%. But if you take a 20% debt ratio and you value the company, the value you get is $141 billion, much higher cost of capital. I end up with $12 billion. Now I give them the bill. I said, is that enough cost for you, $12 billion? And if you do this, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get in front of those shareholders at the next annual meeting. And after you boast about your rating and say, by the way, you pay $12 billion for that boast and put it to a vote. And I'll wager you're going to lose. Because your ego should not be worth that much. So when you look at companies putting in unrealistic ratings constraints, do a traditional capital structure spreadsheet, come up with the optimal, come up with the value at the rating constraint and take the difference. And this isn't some, you know, it's pragmatic. There are companies out there who refuse to borrow money. Implicitly, they've said, we want a AAA rating. The only way we can keep this is by never borrowing money. And as they become mature, they leave more and more value on the table because they're giving up too much in terms of benefits to their shareholders. Coming, I agree, from the tax code, but it is a legal way to create value for your shareholders. You're not taking advantage of it. Until what happens? Somebody says, you're leaving too much money on the table. I'm going to take a position in your company and either going to take over your company or push you to change. You're inviting activist investors into the game. This is why when companies get targeted by activist investors, rather than feel sorry for them automatically, take a look at what they've done over their history to that drew activist investors in, and this is one of those things. So we've looked at why should we do it, $19.6 billion. What if something goes wrong? It looks like Disney has a good buffer here, right? So I'm pretty comfortable with the 40%, at least in the case of Disney. They asked the third question, which is this entire process was built around the assumption you were going to borrow the $39 billion and buy back stock or pay a special dividend. They both have the equivalent effect. What if you don't want to do that? What if you have great investment plans? This seems like a wasteful thing to do, is to buy back stock and then go out and raise capital to build a new theme park or make new movies. So the question you get asked is, what if instead of buying back stock, we took projects instead? Will our optimal debt ratio change? I'll give you the easy answer and the more nuanced one. No, as long as you stay with your same existing business mix. Remember the five businesses that Disney owns? So if you want to build more theme parks, make more movies, you know why? Because the business itself will scale up then. So whatever operating income you had before is going to be higher because. So I said it was a kind of a the easy response, but there's a more nuanced one. When you have this much excess debt capacity, 39 and a half, you don't have enough theme parks to build or movies to make with it. So what do companies want to use that excess debt capacity to do? What kind of investment can suck up that much money? They want to acquire, they want to enter a new business. And then all bets are off, right? Because then I have to recompute the optimal by doing what? By taking in the characteristics of the new business they're entering and asking how risky is it, what are its cash flows? So let's say Disney 3 years ago, Bob Chapek had said, look, we have a lot of debt capacity. We want to enter the streaming business. Great, okay. Yeah, I can see your motives for doing it. But take me through the characteristics of the streaming business in terms of risk, low risk or high risk? It's high risk, it's a young business. In terms of cash flows, nice positive cash flows or big negative cash flows? It's a cash burning machine. So basically you're entering a risky cash burning business. You know, intuitively, you know what's going to happen to the optimal, right? The optimal is 40% before you told me this. What would you expect the optimal to look like after you told me the kind of business you want to enter? It's going to be lower because you're entering a riskier business, which is cash burning. You're not going to have as much cash to pay off the debt. It's common sense. You cannot give companies a blank check of saying, you have excess debt capacity, you do whatever you want, because they will. And what they do can very quickly eat away at why you told them you had an excess debt capacity in the first place. So when you finish the optimal for your company, finish the process of asking why should they do it. And the spreadsheet gives you the dollar value, but I want you to think about the intuition of where that value is coming from and what it tells you. As what if something goes wrong? Look at your company's history, look at the industry, use common sense. What kind of business is it in? You could be in a stable business, but disruptors have showed up. That could be a factor in saying, you know what, I could borrow a lot, but I'm not going to do it right now because the business is changing. And then finally, address and answer the question, or raise and answer the question of, what if I want to invest back in the business? Is this optimal going to hold up? And that's going to require an assessment of what management wants to do with that money. Any questions on those? So I'm going to take what I did for Disney and apply it on my other companies. I'm not going to torture you by taking through you through the entire long process, but by now you know I estimate the cost of equity, the levered beta, cost of debt with the rating. So I started by looking at Tata Motors. Okay. So if you look at Tata Motors, I've done exactly what I did for Disney. I used the same spreadsheet, incidentally. And if you look at the second to last column, you have the cost of capital. So what's the optimal debt ratio for Tata Motors? You go down, it looks like about 20% debt. Why is it lower? Country risk, it turns out, pushes down optimal debt ratios because it affects your cost of debt, your cost of equity. In general, it pushes up the volatility of the company. So I'm not surprised, 20%. They were actually at about a 29% debt ratio. So unlike Disney, they're on this other side of the transaction. I'm not going to freak out. They're not on the verge of distress, but clearly they have too much debt. So when I finished this analysis, I said, that's interesting. They've borrowed too much money. So I took a look at the other. Remember, this is part of a family group of companies. So I looked at Tata Steel, overlevered. Tata Chemicals, overlevered. And then I looked at Tata Consulting Services, which is their crown jewel. It's about 60% of the value of the family group comes from this company, and they had no debt. And I'm going to make, and I can't prove this, but I'm going to make a statement that I think you need to think about with family groups, which is, in my view, here's what I think is happening. Tata Motors, Tata Steel, Tata Chemicals are borrowing, in a sense, against Tata Consulting Services debt capacity. You think that makes no sense. They're independent companies. You're a banker in Mumbai. Tata Motors comes to borrow money from you. Do you think about the family group behind the company as well when you lend money? Yeah, you realize that the family group is not going to let Tata Motors go under. It is implicit. It's not an explicit part of your contract. It's a very dangerous thing for lenders to do. It's like the money lender in Genoa in the 1400s and this wastrel son of a very wealthy, nobleman comes into your, I want to borrow money. This guy's incapable of. But he lend him the money anyway because you know his father will back it up. In a sense, that's what you're doing here, is you're lending money to a family group company because you think the family group will back it up. Could it blow up in your face? Absolutely. There's a classic example from the UAE. where Dubai ports went and borrowed money, and they borrowed money. If you take the UAE, the money bags are with Abu Dhabi. That's the oil-rich part of the UAE. So Dubai ports was borrowing money. They were borrowing way too much. And you know what the bankers were implicitly assuming? If Dubai ports gets into trouble, Abu Dhabi will come in and back up the debt. So Dubai ports gets into trouble. The bankers look towards Abu Dhabi, and Abu Dhabi says, why are you looking at us? We're not in the contract. Dubai ports actually defaulted on its debt. And that actually started the process where if you look at the UAE, you get one rating for the UAE, but you also get ratings for Abu Dhabi and Dubai and Sharjah and all the different parts. And they're different because people realize that there's an implicit agreement to pay off the debt, but there's no explicit agreement. But in family group companies, you get this, it's called cross-subsidization. Now, who's being hurt by this cross-subsidization? If you think about these four companies, Tata Motors, Tata Steel, Tata Chemicals, and TCS, who's being? TCS is being hurt. Their debt capacity is being used by people in Tata Motors, Tata Steel, Tata Group. Is there anything you can do about it? Not much. And that's why we looked at corporate governance. You buy into a family group company, you buy into cross-subsidization. There is a control issue, but that's a different issue. In this case, if all of the companies collectively were over-levered, that might be a reason. In the Adani Group, for instance, that was a reason why the company borrowed as much as it did, was the company hated to issue equity. So that could explain why companies collectively in a family group can end up being over-levered if control becomes the dominant factor driving it. In the case of the Tata Group, collectively, they don't have too much debt. It's just that they're older companies have too much debt, but Tata Consulting Services is no debt at all. So at least collectively, I think it's not control as much as, it's a cross-subsidization.
And would the debt be more in the lower of the pyramid or the higher of the pyramid?
It depends, right? It depends on what you're borrowing against. If it's physical assets, often the debt is against the physical assets. So rather than secured or unsecured debt against a company, it's debt against an asset. So it'll vary depending on the business you're looking at. Any questions about Tata Motors? So over-levered. So already we've dismissed the notion that an optimal debt ratio is always 40%. So we've got a 20% in the mix now. Then I looked at Vale. And I, again, computed the optimal. And I got a 30% optimal debt ratio. We're getting a nice mix here. We've got a 40, a 20, and a 30. And the company's actual debt ratio, if you look at it, it's optimal debt ratio was 30%. But remember, Vale is a mining company, and what it makes as operating income is very much a function of iron ore prices. So I showed this optimal to the CFO of Vale. He actually took this class in, I think, in 93 or 94, so I sent it to him, and I said, this is what we came up as an optimal. And their debt ratio was higher, and he said, no, we're not over-levered. And his reasoning was actually a pretty logical one. He said, iron ore prices go up and down. This was a bad year for iron ore prices. You should be looking at a normal year, which actually does make sense for a commodity company. And how would you look at a normal year? I took a very simplistic approach. I took an average operating income over time. So I'm opening that door for those of you who might be looking at an ExxonMobil. When you compute the optimal, you might not want to use last year's operating income. Just look at an average operating income over time. With that average operating income, the optimal debt ratio you get is 50%. Is this guy home free? He's got too much debt. And why is he borrowed money? Because he assumed there's a cycle, and the cycle will kick in, and everything's going to be okay. And for much of the last century, that's been true, right? Commodity prices go through cycles. But here's where I would hold back and be careful about borrowing against a cyclical price. It might take a long time for the cycle to come back. And if there's disruption in the cycle, a change in, if we take oil prices, right, to the degree that climate change might shift us away from fossil fuels, maybe the cycle will look very different. So I'm always wary of companies borrowing against cyclical averages, which is what he's pushing for. And I can borrow more because it's a cyclical average. But something to think about when you think about commodity and cyclical companies is averaging out operating income over time. So 40% optimal for Disney, 20% for Tata Motors, 30% for Vale with their existing operating income, but 50% if you use an average operating income. And then I looked at Baidu. Optimal debt ratio is 10%. And it's barely different from a 0% debt ratio. You're saying, that's weird. They make a lot of money. How come their optimal debt ratio is low? Baidu is a growth company, right? So when you look at a growth company, its market cap is going to reflect growth assets. Remember, this is debt ratios as a percentage of market value, not book value. So when you have a high growth company, the market value is so high that getting to a 10% debt ratio sounds low, right? But if you take a company like Apple, and I say, why don't they go to a 20% debt ratio? I remember Carl Icahn saying, 20% debt ratios, companies use it. That was when Apple was a $2 trillion company. You know, 20% of $2 trillion, that's $400 billion in debt you're taking on. That's a lot of debt, right, in dollar terms. So what you're getting here is the growth, and in general, you'll find this to be true. The optimal debt rate, so those of you working with high growth companies, don't be surprised to see low optimal debt ratios coming about because so much of the value comes from future growth. So their optimal debt ratio was at 10%. Their actual debt ratio was 5%. And when I first showed you the 5%, it looked like an outlier. It looked like Baidu was too little debt relative to my other five companies. But if you think about what kind of company it is and relative to its optimal, the 5% actually makes complete sense. That's pretty much where I would expect them to be given the capital structure. Yes, any questions on? Yes, go ahead.
What if you have a cyclical process that's a little more predictable, like seasonal variation?
Yeah, seasonal doesn't bother me because it's going to work out. I use annual numbers, so seasonal is almost never an issue. It's more of an issue of when you take working capital debt. So seasonal issues don't bother me, but are there any other predictable cyclical things you can think about? Every time you have an election, but the spikes. I'll tell you when you can get predictable spikes. If you have a small movie company that releases one movie or one game every 3 or 4 years, you do get predictable spikes there because you Lionsgate makes a Hunger Games movie, then does nothing for the next 2 years, then makes another. There, it clearly makes sense to smooth things out because that's a very predictable cycle that they go through. So if you're doing a smaller company with a single product, a gaming or a movie company, then I think it definitely makes sense to average things out. You'd never want to use the most recent year because you can overstate the debt ratio if it's a year in which they produced their most recent movie or understate it if it was a year without. Finally, I decided to do the optimal debt ratio for Bookscape. Remember the private independent bookstore? And I ran into a problem right at the start of the process. If you remember how I started the Disney optimal capital structure analysis, I started by taking the market cap of Disney and adding it to debt because that gave me the starting point because that's what I needed to figure out how much debt would I need to get to 10%, 20%, 30%. And already you can see why that's going to be an issue when I do Bookscape, right? There's no market cap. I can use book equity, but book equity is meaningless for a public company. It's even less meaningful for a private company because God only knows what tax issues led them to capitalize things. So I would like a market cap. I don't have it. So I'm going to cheat for the moment. I'm going to estimate what the market cap for Bookscape would be. I'm not good, as I said, I don't want to value it. Here's a quick and dirty way to estimate it. I took the net income that Bookscape had, and I looked at the P/E ratio for book. I know it's incredibly back of the envelope, but you multiply, I just want a starting number, a rough sense of what is the market value of equity. I used that as my market value of equity. So that allowed me to get started. And once I had that, I could do everything else the way I did for Disney. I came up with an optimal debt ratio here. In this case, the optimal debt ratio works out to about 30% debt because everything else still works, but I did use the total beta for my cost of equity. So I'm staying within the rubric that I use to compute the cost of capital for a private company, but I'm using exactly the same process, which is I still want the lowest cost of capital I can. And I ended up with a 30% debt ratio. If you capitalize their leases, which are their big debt, their debt ratio is about 27.8%. So I have a couple of companies in my group that are pretty close to optimal, Baidu and Bookscape. I have Disney being under-levered. I have Tata Motors being mildly over-levered. And Vale being in the middle, depending on whether you thought the cycle was kicking in or the cycle would never come back. We're going to talk about what to do with that conclusion, but you can already see it play out. So I'm going to do a little tangent here, because until 2017, as I said, the U.S. had the highest marginal tax rate in the world. It had the most dysfunctional tax code in the world, because it's the highest marginal tax rate, but about the same effective tax rate as the rest of the world. Reason being that income from abroad would not get taxed till it was brought back to the U.S., all kinds of strange things. So it needed fixing. Everybody agreed it needed fixing. Whether the 2017 fix was the right fix or not, we can debate. But the 2017 tax fix changed corporate tax law more significantly than any of the previous tax reforms. First, it brought the marginal tax rate down to 21% from 35%. The federal corporate tax rate was 35, was brought down to 21. And it accompanied it with other constraints on debt as a tax saving. It constrained interest expenses to be 30% of EBITDA. So in other words, your interest expense, if they got above 30%, you could no longer get the tax deduction. This year, actually, it becomes 30% of EBIT. It's going to be interesting to see, because that's a much tighter constraint, right? 30% of EBIT means it's even less interest expense that's going to be tax deductible. I don't think companies have thought through what this even means. My spreadsheet is still built on the 30% of EBITDA. I have to go change it before you guys, if you guys decide to use that constraint. But basically, both things are pushing down the tax benefits of debt. So, if I took Disney in 2018 after the tax law passed, and I computed the optimal debt ratio, remember my spreadsheet, the tax rate is an input, so I changed that from 35 to 21, and I put in this tax constraint on how much you can deduct. The orange line was what I got as my optimal debt ratio for Disney with the old tax code. Remember, everything else about Disney stays the same. I replace with a new tax code. The gray is the new tax code. I'll give you the good news first. The optimal debt ratio did not change, but at every level of debt, if you compare what I had as my value for Disney under the old tax code and the value under the new tax code, the value is much lower. You say, where's the value going? Back to the taxpayer. Maybe that's not a bad thing, right? Because that increase in value came entirely from taking advantage of the tax code. So has the tax code change removed the need to borrow money? No, the companies will still borrow money. They shouldn't borrow as much money as they did before, and the effect on value is going to be much smaller. So I've been tracking, as I said, the dollar debt at U.S. companies to see if U.S. companies are moving towards what I'd expect them to, less debt after the tax code. There's the 2017 numbers. If you look at the red columns, which is the amount of debt, it doesn't look like they're doing anything. The dollar debt seems to stay the same, you know, and especially if you count the leases, or it's actually going up. But if you look at it as a multiple of EBITDA, the higher the number, more debt you have, U.S. companies collectively have less debt as a multiple of EBITDA than they did 2 years ago. It's a small movement, you're not seeing enough, but it doesn't surprise me, because remember we talked about inertia, how companies are settled in their ways. It might take a decade for companies to wake up and say, oh my God, the tax code changed. It happened in 2017. You're recognizing it in 2027. Finally, you come to that. By then, there'll be a new tax code. That's the problem, is every 10 years, by the time you wake up and say there's a new tax code, you're reacting to the old one. But you can see that tax advantages can change over time as the tax code changes. Any questions on tax codes? So if you're from part of the world and you think about some quirks in your tax code that can affect leverage, you've got to bring it into the process. I'll tell you one quirk, and I think it's I think Chile has it, UK, Australia, where the tax, I told you equity doesn't provide a tax benefit. In the UK and Australia, equity provides a tax benefit. The way it shows up is stockholders are allowed, when they receive dividends, are allowed to offset what they'd have paid in dividends by the taxes the company has already paid. So it effectively makes dividends almost tax-free to shareholders. In Chile, I think it cuts in the opposite direction, which is they tax you more on, it's some stupid law. I mean, I looked at it and said, who writes this stuff? Now, it's about how you get taxed if you pay dividends versus you keep and retained earnings. A lot of Latin American countries have those laws. They do it for, I don't know what, major but it never works out because the incentives just don't work out the way they expect it to. So if you get a chance, look at tax codes, and I would encourage you to look at Latin American tax codes in particular and how dividends versus retained earnings is taxed, and then ask a question, what does this mean in terms of companies borrowing more or borrowing less? In a strange way, the Chilean changes, you know what it's going to do? It's going to make Chilean companies borrow even more money. Who wants to deal with this retained earnings dividends headache when you raise equity? Okay. So that's a cost of capital approach. I like it because it's simple, it's intuitive, but it comes with its limitations. And I'll give you the biggest one. The biggest one is the driver I told you of the optimal debt ratio is the operating income. The operating income stays the same, whether I'm at 0% debt, 10% debt, 20% debt, 30% debt, 40% debt, whether my rating is AAA, AA, single A, triple B, double B. You see where this is going, right? What do indirect bankruptcy costs do? People stop buying your product, your costs get. So the essence of indirect bankruptcy costs is your operating income can actually be affected by how much you borrow because it can have blowback effects on your operations. That's a big issue. It's a fixable issue. But it's an implicit assumption, the traditional cost of capital approach. The second is it's static, right? I took last year's operating income, I built this entire structure around it. What if the operating income changes? And third, and this is kind of a lesser issue, though some people make a big deal about this, but when you lever betas using that equation I gave you for the leverage, you are implicitly assuming that all of the market risk in this company is borne by just the equity investors. I'm not saying lenders bear no risk, but their default risk, we assume, has nothing to do with market risk, which is okay if you're triple B rated. And if you look at a company with a triple B rating or a double A rating or a single A rating, and you look at how their bonds and their shares move, they move in different directions because the bonds are driven by what's happening in the bond market, the shares are driven by what's happening in the equity market. But if you look at high yield bonds, and you take a look at Bed Bath & Beyond, bad example, but you take their stock price and you take their bond price, the bonds and the stock often move in tandem because the bonds now are more like equity than debt because they're driven by these residual claims. What I'm trying to say in an indirect way is those betas we've estimated at very high debt ratios are probably too high because some of that market risk is now going to be borne by the lenders. I've taken the very conservative assumption of all of the debt goes to the equity investors. So when I got to 70, 80, 90% debt, that 6.9 beta is probably more like a 4 because some of that risk gets funneled off. Does that bother me? Here's why it doesn't. I'm not ending up at a 90% optimal. It's true my cost of capital is going to be too high at my very high debt ratios because of it. But if it did bother you, I have a fix. So use this fix when somebody makes a big deal about this. Say, so, okay, you're right. I shouldn't have done it. But to bring in this effect, you need to give me a beta for debt. Turn it back on them. Say, oh, I'm willing to do this, but why don't you give me a beta for debt? You can. It's a real pain in the neck. But you now have to come up with a beta for your bond. And you can't go to Bloomberg and run a regression to do this. Maybe based on the rating, you can say typically triple C rated companies have betas like 0.5. Put the onus back on people who are nitpickers, because that's what you're doing. You're nitpicking, say, I'm not going to use the approach because I don't like the assumption you're making on beta. I'm willing to modify it if you're willing to do the hard work. You're not willing to do the hard work, then stop nitpicking. Because otherwise, you'll never get any process started, because always a part of the process we have simplified. You made that purist assumption. So I'm going to introduce a second approach. I'm going to call it the enhanced cost of capital approach. There's not that much enhanced about it, but I'll explain what I'll do differently. First is, rather than keep the operating income the same at every debt ratio, I'm going to tie it to your rating. You know what I mean by tie it to your rating? If your rating goes from AA to AAA to BBB to BB, I'm going to start to adjust your operating income down at lower ratings. Why? Because of the indirect bankruptcy costs. So if you're a company like Boeing where the indirect bankruptcy costs are huge, going from BBB to BB might cause a 50% drop in operating income. So now in addition to the cost of capital changing, your operating income is also going to change. I can also make the operating income more dynamic, right? Right now I have a point estimate from last year, but I can make it a distribution. Remember how we use Monte Carlo simulations? So you can make that a distribution. Say, what will my optimal look like if I let this number vary based on history? So let's try at least the first adjustment. So remember how I looked up the rating for your company based on your interest coverage ratio in that lookup table? There's an extra column in that lookup table that's already built into the spreadsheet. So if you say, look, I'm not comfortable with leaving operating income as is. I think it will change as my rating changes because I worry about indirect bankruptcy costs, and you check it off. Then I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. Is it the kind of company with high indirect bankruptcy costs, medium or low? It's a subjective judgment. So if you're looking at a grocery store, you'll say it's low. If you're looking at an aircraft manufacturer, it'll be high. And here's what I'm going to do to adjust your operating income. As I compute a synthetic rating, if your rating drops to BBB and you have low distress costs, I'm going to knock your EBITDA down by 5%. Why? Because there's some loss even for low. But it's going to be much higher if you have no 10. So basically, you see 5, 10, 15. Basically, the more I worry about indirect bankruptcy costs, the bigger the impact will be of a drop in the rating. I mean, mechanically, here's what I'm doing. I'm changing your cost of capital as your debt ratio increases. And if your debt ratio lowers the cost of capital, I'm saying that's good. But I'm saying, wait. But I'm also changing your operating income. And it might entirely be possible that even though your cost of capital is lower, the loss you have in operating income is so big that I shouldn't go to a 40% debt ratio. It's a messier process because I now have to value the firm at every debt ratio. Because with a new operating income and a new cost of capital, I get a different value. It's built into the spreadsheet. As I said, I look at the bottom line. I've got the value of the firm at every debt ratio, but now I've built in the effect of the drop in operating income. So I tried this for Disney. So if you bring in the bankruptcy cost and you factor them in, it becomes an issue, especially as you get to the lower levels. There's my cost of capital. It actually still stays at 40%, but the value effect you're getting is immense once you get to that tipping point. You see why the tipping point becomes even more scary now? Because when you tip over from investment grade into below, not only is your cost of debt going up, but your operating income is also going to go down because of that indirect bankruptcy cost. So if I warned you about getting close to the tipping point with the traditional cost of capital approach, I'm going to warn you even more with this approach is be careful. If you're borrowing, maybe stay 20% away from your optimal. I got luckier that the optimal did not change, but if you, for your company, want to check this out, you can check off the box of what, you know, put the indirect bankruptcy cost in. Don't be surprised if you see your optimal shift down. You'll have lower optimal debt ratio. And that makes intuitive sense. The more you worry about the blowback effects, the feedback effect on operating income, the less money you should borrow as a company.
Which column did you put Disney in?
I think it was the medium column, right? It was not quite a grocery store, but it has businesses that could get impacted. If I were doing Boeing, I'd put it in the high. So it's a judgment call. So but the effect is going to play out in that EBITDA number and how. So one company, yes, go ahead, Chandra.
So in that previous case, so how do we decide which debt ratio to stay at, especially like given the optimal is?
You want to maximize value, right? So the last column is the maximized value. That'll tell you the optimal. In this case, my value is maximized at the 40%. But the value already incorporates that risk, right? I mean, you can't use the "it is risky" after the fact, right? In all of finance, if you say it is risky after the fact, we haven't done our homework. The whole job in finance is to bring the risk in, so we cannot use that argument of it's risky. So this last column can now be give you a different optimal than the second to last column. So in this case, it did not happen. Because the operating income and the cost of capital are both changing, you could end up with the optimal at 20% with the value and 40% of the cost of capital. Go with the 20% then, because that's the end game here, is to maximize the value of the business. And if both are changing, that's what you need to focus on. Now, the one company I've studiously avoided in all of this financing mix discussion is Deutsche. And I told you why, right? I said defining debt for a bank is, you know, kind of like trying to get your hands around something that keeps moving on. You're throwing jello against a wall. It's impossible to define, so I'm not going to try. It's difficult to ask and answer the question, does a bank have too much debt? But could I reframe the question, can a bank have too little equity? right? SVB, the you know, Credit Suisse. When banks get into trouble, it's too, you think too little relative to what? Relative to what? When relative to their risk, but based on regulatory, there's a regulatory capital. So you can have too little equity if you end up with your regulatory capital being lower than it needs to be given the risk you've taken on. You're saying, how would that happen? How does your, you know, your equity get too low? What are the things that cause banks? One is anytime you lose money, remember it comes. So if you have big loss after big loss, a trader runs away with $8 billion, right? What is it, Societe Generale? There goes $8 billion of your equity, right? Overnight, you've gone from being a well-capitalized bank to an undercapitalized bank. So it's trading losses, big losses, what else? It could be that if you mark to market, SVB, the minute you mark to market, remember that the bonds that were, that's a drop in your book equity. That's why they were trying to issue $3 billion in new equity to make up for it. It could be a fine. In the case of Deutsche in 2016, there was a Department of Justice fine attached to something they did in 2008, $15 billion. It comes out of book equity. Lots of different reasons can happen. So when you think about a bank, rather than ask, does it have too much debt, the question you're asking is, does it have too little equity? So let's do a very simplistic example. Now, I want to keep this a traditional bank. Let's say you have a bank that has made $100 million in loans. Remember, that's your business. You lend out money. And let's assume that right now its book value of equity is $6 million. For the moment, let's assume regulatory capital and book equity are the same thing. So right now, it has a 6% regulatory capital ratio. It has $100 million. It's a high growth bank. It's got lots of ambitions. So next year, the bank says, we expect our loans to grow from 100 to 150 million. Make more loans. It's a 50% growth. This is good, right? And they say, oh, by the way, we also want to become safer as a bank. We want to take that capital ratio from 6% to, in this case, let's say 7% of loans. So they want to grow and they want to get safer. Okay. So let's work it out. So next year you'll have 150 million in loans. 7% of 150 is 10.5 million. Right now you're at 6 million, so you need to come up with an extra 4.5 million in equity. Your task is laid out. Let's go through the easy ways or the nice ways of raising equity, and then let's talk about the more messy ways. What would be a best case scenario? You make a lot of income. Let's say you make $5 million in net income. Remember, book equity goes up when you have retained earnings, right? So if you have a lot of net income, then I'm going to go there first. And if you're paying dividends, you know what I'm going to ask you to do? Stop. They won't listen, but I'm going to say stop. But if you listen and you made a lot of money, one way you can get the extra $4.5 million is from making a net income and using the retained earnings. But let's say you make only $1 million in net income, or $1.5 million, then you have a deficit. And my advice to the bank is you need to raise equity. It's very similar to the advice I'm giving for traditional companies, but here it's framed up, you need to raise equity. Why? Because you don't have enough equity to keep going as a bank, given the risk of your loans and given the buffer you need to build in. I kept it a simple bank, but you can see how banks can get messy, because in addition to making loans, you have investment banking businesses and trading businesses. In theory, your regulatory capital should reflect the risk of what you're doing. The reason I'm saying in theory, because let's face it, the regulatory capital guys are always two steps behind the bank. So banks sometimes think this is a game, right? Which is, they get into riskier businesses that they frame as safe businesses to the regulators. They say, we won. We don't have to put in as much in regulatory capital. And they forget a very important lesson. This is not a game. The reason banks have this capital base is to cover their downside. The Rothschilds ran banks for 600 years in Europe without a regulatory capital ratio. You know how they did it? By setting aside the equivalent of a regulatory capital to cover the losses they make in risky businesses. So sometimes you see banks pushing the envelope, essentially trying to make the regulatory capital lower because they can then pay out more dividends, do all the neat stuff. But in the process, they're exposing themselves to risk, and it's your job to step in and say, you guys have too little equity. You need to either stop paying dividends, retain income, and cover it over time, and go out and raise fresh equity. So Deutsche, and this was, I think, in 2013, had a regulatory capital ratio of 15.13%. And Deutsche had been digging itself into a hole. It had been losing money. That ratio had gone from 18% down to 15.13%. So let's say you look at Deutsche and say, I need to bring that regulatory capital ratio up to 18%. Incidentally, none of us has a frame of reference. If I ask you what's a good regulatory capital ratio, who the heck knows, right? But if you have access to S&P Capital IQ, you can download every bank's risk-adjusted assets and every bank's Tier 1 capital and let the data speak to you, tell you what's average, what's low, because nobody carries around this frame of reference. In fact, one of the things I do when I look at banks is I take those numbers and I come up with the 75th percentile, the 50th, the median, the 25th percentile, because otherwise I have no idea where I am in this mix. But if I want to raise the regulatory capital ratio from 15% to 18%, that means my capital has to rise over time. And if my capital has to rise over time, it has consequences. In this case, the way it's going to show up is what I need to invest back in regulatory capital is going to be much larger because I want to raise my regulatory capital ratio. What does that mean? If you look at my cash flows, they're actually negative. So these are the cash flows after that reinvestment. So let's say Deutsche, we're jumping ahead to dividend policy. If I ask you how much should Deutsche pay in dividends, looking at those numbers, what's your answer? Zero. But they continue to pay dividends in 2013 and 2014. And then we wonder why banks get into trouble. Is you're in a capital hole, you should stop paying dividends. You should be building up your capital. But it's almost like they have two channels, one for the dividends and one for the Tier 1 capital, and they think in different terms. So with banks and financial service companies, the question is reframe the financing question of do you have enough equity? And the reason for having equity is to cover the downside you're going to have as a financial service company. If you're an insurance company, you know what the downside is? You have a catastrophe, a flood, a hurricane, $3 billion, $5 billion in payouts. You need to have enough equity to cover those. So every business, that's basically the downside. Yes? To meet the regulatory capital requirements, because I think the point that's being raised is I would like it if all of regulatory capital is defined in terms of book equity. I think it's much healthier. But over time, what the regulatory authorities have done is they've created classes of securities that will be treated like equity. So in the case of Credit Suisse, they issued these bonds which have strange bonds where you actually don't get first claims in the cash flows, don't get first claims. Why you'd buy these bonds, I have no idea. But they create the bonds because those bonds explicitly would be treated as Tier 1 capital. And that was the reasoning. I don't like it when companies thread the needle and create complex securities just to meet regulatory requirements because they almost, two things happen. One is they can't even price these bonds because they're so incredibly convoluted and complex. Somebody will buy them. You have no idea whether you sold them at too low a price or too high a price. You can hire every PhD in math to work through them, but they have like 17 options embedded in there. And by the time you price them all, you've kind of given up. The second is, I think you're making this a game again. This is not a game. If you're in trouble, just go out and issue equity and stop using the argument. It's not a question of expensive. They don't like the dilution. That's the reality of it. Implicitly, the cost to equity is always going to show up in one way or the other. But they just don't like having more shares outstanding. And that's a very bad reason not to issue shares if you're in trouble. So if you look at a financial service company and you think about what strategy to adopt, some adopt the regulatory minimum strategy, which is we're going to have just enough book equity, Tier 1 capital to meet the regulatory minimum. I guess if that's all you cared about. The second is what I think of as a self-regulatory strategy. A sensible bank should be setting aside capital based on its risk of its assets. So you might be setting aside way more than what the regulatory capital person, and that's why I use the example of the Rothschilds. They did this for 600 years. They were incredibly successful because they set aside enough money. And the third is some combination, which is what I think good banks do. They take the regulatory minimum and then they ask the question, is that enough given the risk of what we've taken? Because this is about survival. It's about making sure that you survive that downturn. So as you look at banks, I mean, none of you have picked banks, hopefully, for corporate finance. If you aren't asked the question, is the financing mix right at the bank? Just reframe the question in terms of equity and ask, do they have enough equity? So now I'm going to go back. If you remember, I got very different optimal debt ratios even for my four companies, right? Got 40, 30, 20, 10. I want to ask, why do optimal debt ratios vary across companies? Here's the first factor. And it's one you can test out on your company. The higher your marginal tax rate, other things remaining equal, the higher your optimal debt ratio will tend to get. In fact, if I make your marginal tax rate 0%, with every one of my companies, my optimal debt ratio goes to zero. No surprise there, right? Because if I take away the biggest reason for borrowing money and I leave all the other issues, the bankruptcy costs and agency costs, you shouldn't borrow money. So if you're doing a Almarai, a Middle Eastern company, or you're doing a cruise line where you put in a marginal tax rate of 0.5%, don't be surprised, or a REIT, don't be surprised to get an answer of your company shouldn't borrow money. The fact that they choose to shouldn't stop you from, shouldn't make you revisit and say, I must have done something wrong. You shouldn't be borrowing money if you think about the trade-off on debt. As your tax rate rises, the optimal debt ratio also rises. So in fact, here I've gone from 0 to 50%. Every one of my cases, you can see the effect. It kind of caps out. It's not like I can keep raising the optimal at Baidu when I go to 50% tax rate because I just don't have enough income to cover the interest expenses as I push the debt ratio. So within reason, you're going to see a rise, but it's going to stop at some point. Second factor, and this is a big issue, is if you want to look at, it's actually computed in the spreadsheet. I take your EBITDA and I divide it by your enterprise value. Enterprise value, of course, is market value of equity plus debt minus cash. You think, what does that tell me? It gives me a sense of how much cash flow your company has relative to its market value. The higher that number, so if you look at this, in this case, I've computed that number for each of my companies. That higher that number, the more or the higher your optimal debt ratio can be. Why? Because you need cash flows to service the debt. This is where, if you have a growth company, you're going to see this number become a very small number. Right, because if you take your existing EBITDA, it reflects current business, market value reflects this expectation people have that you'll grow. The lower that number becomes, the lower your optimal debt ratio will be. So tax rates matter, cash flows matter. Does risk matter? Obviously. Riskier businesses will have lower optimal debt ratios. If you look at the mechanisms in my spreadsheet where it shows up in the unlevered beta. And you enter a higher unlevered beta, you're sending me a message about underlying business risk being high. That then gets levered up. You're going to have a much bigger impact of debt if you have a higher unlevered beta as opposed to low unlevered beta. I think Doors Company, as I know yesterday, showed me Michelin unlevered beta of 0.28. You can afford to borrow to 40, 50, 60% debt. That the effect on the beta is much lower. In contrast, if I have an unlevered beta of 1.5, the multiplier effect is going to push me to 6, 7, 8 very quickly. It's also going to show up in the rating you give them at any interest coverage ratio, right? So small, large, risky, safe, you're going to see the effect play out as a higher cost of debt. So riskier companies will have lower optimal debt ratios. So tax rates matter, cash flows matter. Whether you're risky or safe in terms of your underlying business matters. There's a fourth factor, and this is the only macro factor that I track. So you go out and raise equity. There's a price of risk in the equity market, right? What do we call it? We call it the equity risk premium. You go and borrow money, there's a price of risk in the bond market. We call it default spread. Most of the time, the two move together. So when one becomes high, the other also becomes high. So after a crisis, you're saying, what do I use? Both your cost of equity and your cost of debt would have been high. But sometimes, and especially over the last 30 years, we've had at least two cases where we've had the two numbers diverge. Let me take the... So this is a graph of equity risk premiums over the last, from 1960 to 22. That's a red line. And the black line is the default spread on a BAA rated bond. So I've just picked one rating so you can see the price of risk change over time. Let's take the 1990s, right? The 1990s, this is the dot-com boom. The equity risk premium slid down and, in fact, it got down to as low as 2% by the end of 1999. So the price of risk in the equity market is dropping. But default spreads actually stayed pretty stable. So in 1999, the default spread on a on a triple B rated bond, a pretty safe investment grade bond, was roughly the same as the equity risk premium. So let's say you're the CFO of a company, it's 1999. You're asking, should I issue equity or should I borrow money? The price of risk in the equity market is insanely low. The price of risk in the bond market is relatively normal. Which one are you going to use? You want to go where it's cheaper, so you're going to go issue as much equity as you can because it's cheaper. The price of risk has become too low. Telecom companies in the late 90s were issuing equity like it was going out of style because you were raising equity at these really low costs. So companies overissued equity because equity was too cheap. You get to the next decade. Between 2002 and 2007, take a look at what equity risk premiums did. They kind of stayed roughly, in fact, they rose a little bit. And take a look at what default spreads did. Default spreads kept falling. And this was the Greenspan put, right, where Greenspan said, I will not let the economy go into recession. So the price of risk in the equity market is rising. The price of risk in the bond market is dropping. 2006, it's a golden age for a leveraged buyout. Do you see why? You're borrowing money at these really low rates, and you're buying stock at relatively low price, the price of risk. I mean, this, of course, was the trigger for the 2008 crisis. It was the first, I describe it as the first crisis where you could blame the bond market for the crisis, because people were charging too little for default risk in the bond market. And if you look at everything from subprime to housing, that was at the heart of the problem. So when that blew up, it took every market down with it. But it means in 2006 and 2000, you'd be overissuing debt because debt looks too cheap, the price of. So one reason I track equity risk premiums and default spreads in the same graph is I want to make sure if I'm entering a period like that, that I'm ready for what's coming because it's predictable. So that's the only macro factor. Right now, I think the equity risk premium is about 5.5%. The default spreads are about 2%. So it's close to historic norms, nothing unusual, but that could change. So keep your eyes on those two numbers because it's going to give you a sense, at least as a CFO or as a company, which one you should use. Any questions on those macro variables? So I sent you the spreadsheet link. I know none of you have used it. Has anybody tried it out? No, I think Dor tried it out. No. Yeah. And how much time did it take you to put in the inputs? It's like it's 9 inputs, most of which you should already have, assuming you've done other stuff before this, like what's your unlevered beta. So it's a very simple, and it's actually an input that's going to violate the story about the ant and the grasshopper. Is a story about the ant and the grasshopper, the ant's hard working, the grasshopper's dancing. There are other versions of the story, so it's... And the ant works, and then, of course, hard times come. The grasshopper has no food to eat. He goes to the ant, and he says, look, I have no food. And the ant says, what were you doing in the good times? And the grasshopper says, I was partying and dancing. And the moral of the story is the ant says, go starve to death. It's your problem. It's a very morbid story. So the lesson of the story is people who put in the work should get rewarded. I'm going to violate that lesson. Those of you who have not done an ounce of work on the story, if you use the capital structure spreadsheet, it'll actually catch you up on all of the other stuff. Remember the cost of equity, the cost of capital, it's all embedded in there. So if nothing else, doing the spreadsheet will let you get caught up. So it'll give, and then you can boast about this with the other teammates who've actually been working 2 hours a week, every week for the last 7 weeks. I did it in 20 minutes. But no. Go for it. I mean, I'd like you to get caught up. So if you get a chance, try the spreadsheet. It'll give you the optimal debt ratio. It'll also give you the change in value from going to the... In fact, you'll see everything I did for my companies, you should see for yours. But then I want you to think about why is my company's optimal debt ratio what it is. Now, I'm going to give away what the final project is. The project is not you telling me the optimal debt ratio is 30%, because my reaction is I gave you the spreadsheet that gave you the 30%. Telling me 30% tells me nothing. I want you to tell me why your company. So you have 5 companies in your group and you get 30% for one, 0% for another, 50%. And that's why I suggested you pick diverse companies, because then you'll get diverse optimals. You can talk about why you get higher optimals for some and lower optimals for others. And the answers are going to be either in the tax rate or in the cash flows. I want you to think about the why rather than the what. The what's simple. AI at some point will do the entire number crunching on your corporate finance spreadsheet. But AI can't do the why, and that's what I wanted to think about. Why is my optimal? High, low, zero? Because that's going to give you insight into the financing mix question. So that's the enhanced cost of capital approach. There's a third approach called the APV approach, the adjusted present value approach, and the people who use this approach are obnoxious people. Yeah. They're people who believe that, they'll tell you, and perhaps it's because the people who teach them might be obnoxious people as well, they're told that this is the only way to do optimal debt ratios. We use the APV approach, play along. Because I'm going to give you the tools and the questions that are going to render them naked in terms of what approach they're actually using. So the APV approach, here's how you approach your optimal debt ratio. You start by estimating what the value of your business would be if it had no debt. It's called an unlevered firm value. And I'll give you a couple of ways you can get there. And then it takes the debt separately and it asks the question, what's the biggest advantage of it? It's the tax benefit, right? It says the expected tax benefit, computes a value increase in the tax benefits, and at least in theory, subtracts out the expected bankruptcy cost from the debt. And you're going to see in a minute why I said at least in theory. So the question of should I borrow money, you compute the effect of debt, and you say you should borrow money because your value goes up or it doesn't. So what are the inputs I need? I need an unlevered firm value. I need to compute the tax benefits of debt. I need an expected bankruptcy cost. So let's set up the process. First, I need an unlevered firm value. You're saying, how the heck do I do it? There are two ways, the long way and the short way. I'd strongly recommend you take the short way. But the long way is to do a full-fledged valuation of your company. We estimate cash flows, but instead of discounting at a cost of capital, you discount at an unlevered cost of equity. What are you doing then? You're essentially saying, if I have no debt, that's what my cost of capital would be. So it's an unlevered firm value, full-fledged valuation. That's a lot of work. You've got to do revenue growth and margins. So here's the cheating, short way. You already have a market value of the firm, right? That market value reflects what this company already has as debt. It reflects the tax benefits of debt and the expected bankruptcy cost of debt. So you take the existing enterprise value of the firm and you back out those effects. What does that mean? You subtract out the tax benefits by saying if I had no debt, those tax benefits would not exist. And then you add back the expected bankruptcy cost by saying if I didn't have debt, then I wouldn't have to worry about bankruptcy costs. In effect, you're starting with the enterprise value and taking out the effects of debt. Either way, you end up with an unlevered firm value. That's what the value of your firm is at 0% debt. Let's bring in the tax benefits of debt. Tax benefit interest is tax deductible, right? So you have $100 million in interest expenses and you have a 25% tax rate, you're going to save $25 million in 1 year. What if you have this every year for the next 10 years? You're going to save $25 million every year for the next 10 years. What if you have a firm that essentially has decided to use $100 million debt in, as long as it continues to perform? You're going to save $25 million every year in perpetuity. The present value of a perpetuity. You take the $25 million, you divide it by your cost of debt here because it's the same risk as debt. You're going to come up with a present value. The tax benefits of debt, very simple. In fact, in the simplest form, you can just take your dollar debt and multiply by a tax rate because the present value is going to converge on that number. So you borrow $100 million, you have a 25% tax rate, your present value of tax benefits over the life of the debt is going to be roughly $25 million. So the unlevered firm value is not a big deal. Getting the tax benefits of debt is not a big deal. Then you turn to expected bankruptcy costs. What are the two numbers I need? I need a probability of bankruptcy. Maybe I can do a dance and give you that number. But I also need a cost of bankruptcy, direct and indirect, as a percentage of the value. That's a nightmare to estimate. Why? Because it's unobservable, right? So if you lose revenues, you can't see what you've lost. You just report lower revenues. So you know what APV people do? They do step one. They do step two. They get to step three and they start waving their hands and say, too difficult to do, we're going to ignore it. So the APV in practice, here's what ends up happening. You take the unlevered firm value, you add the tax benefits of debt, and you ignore the expected bankruptcy costs. Tell me what's going to happen. I count the good stuff from debt. I don't count the bad stuff. So I go to 10% debt, my value goes up. I go to 20% debt, the value goes up even more. Now do you see why LBO people like APVs? Because 90%, it's going to increase. Of course, it's going to increase your value, dummy. Because you subtract, you forgot to subtract out the biggest problem with debt, which is the expected bankruptcy cost. Have that weapon ready. The next time that University of Chicago is the one that APV is the religion, shows up and says, I use only APV. Say, go along. Say, okay, tell me how you get the unlevered firm value. You might do a little, you know, convoluted way, but let's get, you'll do the tax benefit. And say, wait, you forgot the expected bankruptcy costs. He say, and he's going to say, what expected bankruptcy costs? Because to him, this is always an equation. You don't do the expected bankruptcy costs. This is not an approach to estimating how much debt you should borrow. It's just a half-assed approach. You forgot a big component of value. So next session when I start, I'm going to take you through using the APV approach, even though I never use it for Disney. And I'm going to point out the weakest links. And so.